Imagine for a second that you're walking through your day, just going about your normal business, but you have this invisible arrow stuck directly in your chest.
Oh, man. Yeah.
Right, but instead of, stopping and actually pausing to pull it out, you just spend your entire life running frantically in all directions, like trying to outpace the bleeding,
You're
basically,
just running.
hoping that the next distraction or the next big accomplishment will just finally make that pain go away.
It is, it's a really profound and honestly pretty unsettling image.
It really is.
But it perfectly captures the underlying reality of human suffering, I think, especially when we're dealing with our most deeply ingrained harmful compulsions.
Right.
Because when we were caught up in those patterns, we're usually just running from that arrow.
We really are. And, we're looking at this landscape of human behavior today that the RAF program refers to as the dangerous shore. Yeah, and it's turbulent, it's confusing, and those quick fix software patches we always try to apply to our lives, they don't work there.
No, they don't hold up.
Exactly. So that is our mission for today's deep dive. We are exploring a framework for navigating life's inevitable pain, the confusion we all face, and really the habits we use to manage our pain, difficulties, and disappointments.
Yeah, and specifically, we are unpacking a framework from the RAFT program. And just to clarify for everyone, RAFT is an acronym. It stands for Recognize, Abandon, Feel, Train.
Right.
And we pronounce it simply as the spoken word raft, just, like the boat.
Like the boat, exactly. And just to set some boundaries for today's conversation, we are focusing solely on the R in that acronym. So recognize.
Just the first step.
Right, because before you can even begin to, gather materials to build a raft to cross over from that dangerous shore,
What?
you have to survey the terrain. You have to actually recognize that life is naturally painful, difficult, and disappointing.
Yeah, you can't escape a trap until you acknowledge you're actually standing in one.
Exactly. So to guide us through this initial stage of recognition, the RAFT program turns to a historical figure, which is Gautama, the Buddha.
And it is so crucial to establish right away that, we're not talking about some mythical being or a fairy tale character here. We are looking at a deeply human historical account from about 2,600 years ago.
Yeah, and knowing the actual history, it really shifts the perspective because, popular stories always paint him as this pristine prince, right? Locked in this perfect castle, just blissfully unaware of everything.
Right, the fairy tale version.
Exactly. But the reality that's laid out in the RAF program is it's just far more complex. He was born into the Sakya clan, which was this aristocratic republic up in the Himalayan foothills. And this was a remarkably turbulent era.
Oh, incredibly turbulent. It was a time of just massive political upheaval. His republic was essentially a vassal state, and they were living under the shadow of this much more powerful kingdom called Kosala. Wow. Okay. Yeah. So they were dealing with armed disputes, fights over water rights, things like that. The tension in the air would have been just palpable.
Right, so he wasn't just sitting in a quiet, peaceful kingdom.
Not at all.
Yet, despite all that outside tension, his personal life was essentially this gilded cage. The RAF program describes just an absurd level of luxury.
It really is wild when you read about it.
Yeah, like he had three stilted longhouses, so one for winter, one for summer, and one just for the rainy season.
Naturally.
Right. And he was entertained constantly by musicians. He wore only the finest Varanasi sandalwood. Basically, every single physical need was anticipated and catered to. He was completely insulated from hardship.
It sounds totally idyllic on paper, but that kind of insulation, it comes with a profound psychological cost.
It does. It makes me think of a modern tech billionaire, right?
Oh, that's a good comparison.
Yeah, someone who has just every conceivable luxury, personal chefs, private islands, every possible distraction right at their
The
fingertips.
best health care, the best food.
Exactly. And yet, they still wake up at 3 a.m. with this profound, unshakable existential dread. Because having the whole world doesn't actually stop the unease.
It doesn't. And
Yeah.
that dread is exactly what grew within Gautama. Despite having unparalleled external comfort, he realized his entire life was built on this super fragile foundation of denial. He recognized that he, and honestly almost everyone around him, was heavily intoxicated by three specific things:
Okay.
the vitality of youth, the vigor of health, and the continuity of life itself.
The three intoxications. And, just to be super clear for our listeners, being intoxicated here, it doesn't mean substance use.
Right. No.
It means a state of deep delusion, right?
Exactly. It's the delusion of false security. So, like, to be intoxicated by youth is to kind of look down on the elderly or ignore aging.
Oh, sure.
To be intoxicated by health is to feel repelled by the sick. We build these internal stilted longhouses, whether it's our wealth, our status, or even the destructive cravings and habits we use to numb out. We do it hoping they will insulate us from the inescapable reality that, well, aging, illness, and death are coming for all of us.
Wow. Yeah, that brings us right back to that visceral image we opened with, because Gautama didn't just feel this foggy, vague sense of unease. He was actually able to pinpoint its exact source.
Yes.
The RAFT program notes that he saw people just thrashing about in conflict, and he identified the cause as, and this is a quote, an arrow here, so very hard to see, embedded in the heart.
It is so hard to see.
Oh.
Because it represents this really subtle, often unconscious inner wound.
Yeah.
And it's caused by our deepest afflictions, you know, delusion, craving, self-centered views.
Right.
And I think the most dangerous part isn't even the arrow itself, but the behavior that it triggers. When we're struck by it, we don't sit down and tend to the wound.
No, we run.
Yeah, we run frantically in all directions trying to escape the pain.
We seek satisfaction, we seek escape, but we never find peace. And this leads to his first realization, which is known as dukkha.
Dukkha, yes.
Which is the fundamental truth that life is naturally painful, difficult, and disappointing. Like, even pleasant experiences are impermanent, so they can never provide lasting, secure happiness.
And realizing dukkha, I mean, it completely shattered the walls of his gilded cage. It culminated in what the RAFT program calls the four propositions.
Okay.
And these are just raw, piercing insights into the actual nature of reality.
Let's walk through those slowly, because they are heavy.
They are very heavy.
Okay, so the first proposition. All beings are swept along toward old age and death, meaning the world is fundamentally unstable.
Yeah. And the second one is life is insecure and nothing is truly within our control. So the world has no shelter and no savior.
Man. Okay, the third. We possess nothing. Everything must be relinquished at death, meaning the world has no owner.
And then the fourth. There is a lack at the core of every life. No one is fully satisfied, for beings are enslaved by craving. The world is insatiable.
The world is insatiable. You know, the RAFT program tells the story of Ratapala, right? He was this wealthy nobleman who hears these four propositions, and he is so shaken to his core that he just immediately abandons his lavish lifestyle to follow Gautama.
Right on the spot.
Right. But okay, I have to pause here. Because if I am listening to this on my commute right now, going to work,
yeah,
this framework sounds intensely, almost paralyzingly pessimistic.
Oh, I totally get that. It can definitely sound that way at first glance. But, you know, it's really not about pessimism. It is about shattering false security.
Okay, explain that a bit more.
So think of it like, imagine you're standing on a rotting bridge over this massive, deep gorge.
Okay, terrifying, but I'm with you.
Right. Pointing out that the wood is decaying underneath your feet, that's not being pessimistic. That is necessary information to save your life.
Okay, I get the rotting bridge analogy. I really do. But acknowledging that the bridge is rotting is absolutely terrifying if you don't know how to swim.
Very true.
Like, doesn't realizing the world is unstable and has no shelter, doesn't that just drive people deeper into their harmful compulsions?
It can, yeah.
Because if it's all going to collapse anyway, why not just, I don't know, numb out completely.
And that is a very real reaction,
uh-huh.
Right? That is exactly why the arrow causes us to run.
Yeah.
Yes, acknowledging the rot is terrifying if you don't have a way off the bridge. But acknowledging the rot is the absolute non-negotiable prerequisite for actually building a raft.
I see.
If we, you know, connect this to modern psychology, denying the four propositions keeps us trapped on what we call the hedonic treadmill.
Ah, right. The hedonic treadmill.
Oh.
The idea that we always return to this baseline level of happiness, no matter what we buy, achieve, or consume.
Exactly. We convince ourselves, we think, you know, the next promotion or the next purchase or the next time we indulge in a harmful compulsion, that will finally fix the internal pain.
And it never does.
The satisfaction never lasts. We just end up running on the treadmill, endlessly seeking more.
Mm-hmm.
So the four propositions, they force an honest, necessary surrender to the reality that chasing impermanent things will literally never heal the arrow in the heart.
Wow. Okay. So once you actually recognize the arrow, a massive pivot is required. Like, you have to completely change what you are searching for.
Exactly.
And for Gautama, it meant making this radical, almost unthinkable decision. He resolved to leave his life of privilege, leaving behind his wife, Yasodhara, his newborn son, Rahula, and all of his wealth.
Yeah, he felt that his home life had become, the text calls it a confinement, a basis for dust.
The basis for dust.
Yeah, like this cramped space just filled with obligations that kept stirring up the dust of passion and confusion, basically blinding him.
Right.
So he had to go from that dusty confinement out into the open space of mental and spiritual clarity. And he called this the noble search.
Okay, so let's contrast that for a second, because understanding the ignoble search versus the noble search is really vital here. The ignoble search is when we seek happiness in things that are subject to change, decay, and loss.
Which is, let's be honest, the default state for most of humanity.
For sure, yeah. And the cycle of our harmful compulsions is really the most intense manifestation of the ignoble search.
Rich, yes, absolutely.
Like, we are frantically seeking permanent relief in temporary fixes, you know, whatever behaviors we use to numb out. We are looking for a savior in something that is constantly decaying.
Perfectly said. The noble search, on the other hand, is the quest for a lasting freedom from that entire cycle of suffering. A freedom that is not dependent on changing external conditions.
Wow.
And for anyone listening right now, the noble search begins the very moment we decide to stop running on the dangerous shore and actually start building our raft.
But, and this is important, deciding to build the raft doesn't mean you automatically know how to build it.
Oh, definitely not.
Right. Gautama didn't walk out of his palace and just instantly achieve lasting peace. The raft program details this rigorous process of trial and error that took him 6 long years.
6 years of just gathering materials, testing them out, and discarding what didn't work. I mean, first he went to the most esteemed meditation teachers of his time. He mastered their advanced techniques and achieved these profound states of mental concentration.
But those states were temporary. When the meditation ended, he realized the underlying unease, you know, that arrow, it was still there.
Yeah.
So having found that insufficient, he swung to the complete opposite extreme.
Which was extreme self-mortification.
Mm.
Fasting, agonizingly painful postures, severe neglect of his physical body.
Oh, man.
He pushed himself to the absolute brink of starvation, operating under this assumption that if he just punished the physical body enough, it would somehow liberate his mind.
You know, this part resonates so deeply with how we operate today. Like, it instantly reminds me of modern binge and restrict cycles.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Right. So often, we swing wildly from the extreme of giving in completely to our harmful compulsions, directly into the extreme of harsh self-criticism and punishing rigidity.
It's so common.
We think, oh, I was bad, so now I must suffer and deprive myself to fix it.
And Gautama proved thousands of years ago that self-harm and shame are rotten materials. You cannot build a durable raft out of them.
No.
Realizing that self-punishment was a dead end actually led to his greatest breakthrough. He was exhausted, starving, and he recalled this memory of sitting in the cool shade of a tree when he was just a boy.
Oh, wow.
And in that memory, he had spontaneously entered this state of deep, wholesome, pleasant calm.
So he realized that there was a kind of wholesome pleasure, you know, born of clarity and peace that could actually support his path.
Yes.
So he accepted nourishing food, he regained his strength, and he laid out the core principle of the middle way, which is a sustainable path that completely avoids the two extremes of excessive sensual indulgence and harsh self-denial.
Right. But implementing this middle way, it required him to navigate what the tradition calls Mara.
Ah, yes. Mara the saboteur. But we definitely have to clarify what this means, because the raft program makes it very clear. This isn't some literal demon with horns hiding in the bushes trying to trip him up.
No, not at all. Mara has a lot of psychological weight. It represents the very convincing, highly rational inner whispers of doubt.
The inner voice.
Exactly. It's the voice in your head that says, hey, you had a really hard day. You deserve to numb out just for tonight.
Oh, I know that voice.
Right. Or you've already messed up your diet today. You might as well eat everything in the kitchen. Mara is just the lure of those old destructive cravings that try to pull us off course, and they usually present themselves as completely flawless logic.
So if self-punishment doesn't work, right, and indulging the whispers of Mara doesn't work, what do we actually do when that craving hits at, like, 5 p.m. on a Tuesday.
Good question.
Like, how did Gotama translate this middle way into a Tuesday afternoon habit? Because I find it fascinating that the mechanics of this ancient process actually map perfectly onto modern neuroscience.
They absolutely do. It's incredible. Let's look at the actual mechanism of craving for a second. The habits we use to manage pain literally hijack the brain's natural reward system.
Okay.
When we engage in destructive cravings, we flood the brain with dopamine.
But it's not just that we get a spike in dopamine, right? It's what the brain actually does in response to that massive flood.
Exactly. Think of it like being in a room where someone just cranks the stereo up to a deafening volume.
Okay.
To protect itself, your brain essentially puts in earplugs. It reduces its own sensitivity to dopamine. This is a process called downregulation.
Ah, so the volume of everything else gets turned down too.
Yes. Normal, natural rewards like, you know, a good meal, a walk with a friend, seeing a beautiful sunset, they become too quiet to hear. They're no longer satisfying at all.
It is so sad.
It is. And you now need more and more of the harmful habit just to feel a baseline level of okay, which just traps you in this painful compounding loop.
But the middle way actually offers a mechanical way out through neuroplasticity. Like, we can physically rewire the brain.
We can. By practicing mindfulness and consistently choosing the middle way, we strengthen the prefrontal cortex.
The prefrontal cortex.
Yeah, you can think of the prefrontal cortex as the brain's brakes and the amygdala, which is the emotion and fear center, as the gas pedal.
Oh, I like that.
Our harmful compulsions keep the gas pedal floored. Mindfulness strengthens the brakes, allowing us to steer away from those automatic compulsive loops and move toward conscious, healthy choices.
Which brings us perfectly to the practical toolkit in the RAFT program. It uses Gotama's name as an acronym for a daily experiment in awareness.
It does.
I really want to walk through this G-O-T-A-M-A practice slowly, because this is the actual tangible application of the middle way.
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay, so G stands for ground yourself. When you feel a craving or irritation, instead of running away, pause. Ground your awareness in your body. But, I mean, grounding is physically difficult when you have a craving because your body is basically screaming at you to run.
You're right, it's panic.
So you just name the difficulty. You feel the arrow and you say, this is hard. Let kindness be here.
That's huge. And then O is observe the intoxications. This is about noticing your own judgments and subtle assumptions. So when you feel resistance to aging, or you get frustrated that you're sick, you just gently note to yourself, intoxicated with youth or intoxicated with health.
Just naming it.
Yeah. You were just observing the delusion without criticizing yourself for having it.
I love that. Okay, T is taste open space. We talked about Gotama's life feeling like a dusty confinement. So the practice here is to find just 5 minutes of silence today.
Just 5 minutes.
Maybe with a cup of tea, with no phone, no podcast, no input.
Taking those 5 minutes is so crucial. Because you are literally rehearsing what freedom feels like for your nervous system. You have to remind your brain what the quiet sounds like.
What the quiet sounds like.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay, A is acknowledge the raw truth. Take one of those four propositions we discussed earlier, like the world is unstable, and just hold it lightly in your mind. Notice how it shows up in small ways, like when a meeting gets canceled or it rains on a day you plan to be outside.
Yeah, you are aligning yourself with reality instead of constantly fighting it.
Right. And then M is map your confinement. Take a moment to recognize the walls of your own cramped room. What does this look like? Maybe it's recognizing that doom scrolling at 11 p.m. isn't actually relaxing you. It's just stirring up the dust of anxiety and blinding you. You just map the thought patterns and habits that confine you, recognizing them for exactly what they are.
And finally, the last A is awaken the noble search. Form a clear resolve. Set your compass by saying to yourself, seeing the dis-ease of the ignoble search, I resolve to seek genuine well-being.
Ground, observe, taste, acknowledge, map, awaken.
That's the Gotama practice.
I want to ask everyone listening right now to just consider, which of those steps feels most alive for you today? Like, which one feels like the hardest to practice, or maybe the one you most need right now?
It is definitely a question worth sitting with, because building this raft, it's not a quick fix. It is a lifelong journey. I mean, remember, Gotama spent 6 years undergoing rigorous trial and error just to build his raft, and then he spent another 45 years practicing until his dying breath.
45 years.
Right. He was still subject to physical pain and the inevitable difficulties of life, but he chose not to suffer for it. It is a marathon of compassion, not an overnight cure.
It really is. And, you know, as we wrap up today's deep dive, we want to make sure you know exactly where to find all of these tools we've been talking about. The RAFT to Freedom Workbook is written by Dr. Catherine Jacob and Vince Cullen, and they are making the entire 66 chapters freely available online with a link to the website at raft2freedom.org.
And as you step back into your day, consider this specific self-reflection from the RAFT program. When have I noticed myself running in all directions instead of pausing to recognize the arrow?
The curious paradox is that when I accept myself just as I am, then I can change. Carl Rogers.